Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast. It is April 24th, 2022, and this is Jason Fitzgerald. You can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or occasionally writing some articles at overthecap.com. Nelly the Bunny is with me once again. Nelly, anything? No, Nelly's half asleep right now. It's a daytime nap. So, as I mentioned, daytime, we're actually recording this on a Sunday instead of the typical Saturday night, so no beer of the week this week. My daughter had a dance competition this week, and while I didn't go to the competition, my son and I were home pretty much all day yesterday and just couldn't really squeeze it in by the time they got home from the competition. Then they had to get up early this morning and go again today for the next round of the competition or whatever it was. I don't know. So I think I'm going to one of these in a couple of weeks, which is more of an away thing than, I guess, one that you can drive to. So that's the reason for the Sunday recording, so we'll see if this goes as long as usual. Hopefully it'll cut a little bit shorter than last week's, which I thought was going to be short. Ended up running, probably close to 2.5 hours by the time I finished that one up around 1 in the morning or so. So hopefully this one won't go nearly as long, and we'll be able to kind of shorten this one up, though. There is surprisingly a lot of news this week, and there were a couple things I wanted to talk about, and I guess the place to start is the Deebo Samuel news, where he's basically come out and asked for a trade or would like a trade. I guess that there is a contract split of some sort that's there right now. I guess the rumor mill had it that San Francisco offered around $20 million a year, and they're obviously looking for a higher number than that. And when San Francisco didn't come up, basically they said, well, they'd like a trade. Everybody gets all worked up over this stuff. I think it's kind of pointless to get worked up over it. The timing, the trade timing is just because they're doing this before the draft. So what you're trying to do, if you're on the player side of this, you're trying to get a contract done before anything can happen to change your situation. What are things that can happen that can change your situation? Drafting of a receiver, which is doubtful. San Francisco's doesn't really have a first. They don't have a first round pick, right? This year, so that shouldn't really come into play too much. But you don't want situations to change. You're at a high point in terms of what your value is probably going to be. You're coming off a tremendous season. You kind of are going into a big unknown next year with Trey Lance as the quarterback based on stuff that happened last year. And while you don't read a lot into the rookie stuff, you kind of figure that your numbers are probably going to decline. I mean, they're probably going to decline anyway, but there's probably more of a chance with Lance in there, who looks to be much, much more of a developmental prospect, that your numbers are going to go down. On top of that, the style of quarterback he is, some of the things that really got you a lot of attention, running in that San Francisco offense, might get eliminated a bit this year. One is just because teams are going to be more prepared for that. But number two is I have a feeling some of those kind of carries and whatever kind of RPO kind of system they're going to run with Lance, I would guess that some of that stuff is probably going to get designed for him to be moving with the football rather than kind of running the stuff with Samuel in there. So I think you combine that stuff. You also take into account that Kittle was more injured than usual last year, and Kittle's always going to miss some games. But again, that got you to a point of being more of a focal point of the offense. You kind of try and get that deal done now, and you try to push it because you got the draft here, and it's a good time to push it. Every time a player says they want to trade, people talk about like this new leverage that exists for players. It's the new player empowerment. And it comes from a lot of smart people too. And it just really surprises me. Players don't have leverage in these situations. It's very, very rare that a player can really leverage his way off a team. Can a player go so insane that it happens? Yeah, that was Antonio Brown. All these other trades that you see where we want to look at it and go, wow, he really forced his hand out of there. Ask yourself, what team was it that did not want to move the player? I don't know if you can really come up with a good example. What teams are weighing is, basically, it's a couple of things. But the main thing is, okay, they know the player's unhappy. Whether that player is a big star like Russell Wilson or a little bit of a lesser star, whatever it may be, you know the player's unhappy. So you know that you have a situation that you have to manage in the locker room with the unhappy player. So that's one of the things you take into account. The second thing that you just take into account then is, okay, we have this player that's unhappy and he's looking to make a lot of money, which is fine. How does that fit within our framework? How does that fit within our system? And what makes more sense for us? Are we going to be able to come to an agreement with him, or are we possibly going to have to go franchise tag, let him walk, and deal with all the headaches that come with him being unhappy that he doesn't have a contract this year, him being unhappy that he's on a tag next year, him being unhappy that he's on a tag 2 years after that? And then you have to look at it and say, what is our alternative? If he's not going to re-sign with us at any point in time, we can have him here, we can have him be unhappy, we can have him be a pain possibly in the locker room, and we can get maybe a third-round compensatory pick for him a couple years down the line. Or we can try to turn around and spin this into getting first-round draft picks or second-round draft picks. Whatever that draft capital might be, you can spin it into that. And I think you just weigh those different dimensions, and that's how you're making the decision. You're not making the decision because the player wants out. I get Deshaun Watson said, I'm never going to play for the Houston Texans again. Did Houston show any little even inkling that they wanted him to play for them again too? No. Not at all. So don't look at this as like once a player says, I'm gone, they're gone. Teams hold the contracts of these players. They hold the rights of the players for many years. If the player does hold out, and all he has to do is hold out for basically a very brief period of time in training camp, they lose a year towards free agency. That would mean that next year, he would actually be a restricted free agent, not an unrestricted free agent. So instead of landing on a franchise tag, he could potentially end up on something that would be a first-round tender. Now, you might say, all right, given the landscape of some of these trades, a team might give up a first-round pick for him. Okay, you got yourself a first-round pick for him that way. Let somebody else give him the contract. You get your number one. And there's always a lot of question marks that come with the RFA process. I think there's a good thought that there is some collusion that goes on in the RFA thing to where if a player tried to utilize the system to force his way into a bigger contract or whatever it might be, I could see a scenario where the 31 other teams simply say, okay, we're not going to touch because this sets a bad precedent. So I don't see this as a situation where he said he wants out and the 49ers have no options. All right, 49ers can force him to play this out. He doesn't really have a case to just say, I'm gone. Now, would San Francisco trade him? I think San Francisco might trade him. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility, but I think they would need a better package than what the Kansas City Chiefs got for Tyreek Hill, which I thought was a really light number, all things considered. And maybe that's just because of the way that situation went down. Maybe they didn't have a lot of leverage to do it, and they just wanted to get it over and done with. And this was going to be one of those deals where he really just wanted to go to Miami. So you were kind of pigeonholed with one team, and you just kind of found a way to coax the Jets into the situation to try to drive the price up a little bit, because he basically laughed it off like he wasn't going to go to New York, and the Jets clearly weren't going to trade for him if he wasn't going to do an extension with them. So I think you'd be looking, using the Jets as an example, I think you'd be looking at the Jets to give you a first-round pick, and you go, well, why does that make any sense? Now, you've got somewhat of a given here at wide receiver. You don't have a first-round pick on your own this year. You do have a rookie quarterback. Don't you want to give him all the opportunities to succeed? And I can understand why you would think otherwise if you're San Francisco. You're looking about spending a lot of money on a wide receiver. That would be number one. Number two, your quarterback is not really ready, I don't think at least, to make use of the wide receiver. I think from everything we heard about him last year, this is not a situation where you would expect him to just run onto the field this year and take off. Maybe he will, but I don't think it's that kind of scenario. And when you look at Debo's career, it's not as if he's been great for the 3 years he's been in the league. It's basically been this year, right? Let's pull up his numbers. Let's just take a quick look, make sure I'm not completely wrong on this. Yeah, so 15 games as a rookie, 800 yards. I mean, that's pretty solid. That's not, well, maybe in today's NFL, maybe that is $20 million a year solid. you know, but that's not super high end, but that's pretty good for a rookie. He's hurt the next year, and then this year he absolutely explodes with the 1,400-yard season. But I think, again, when you get into the lifespan of a lot of receivers, a lot of players, their player lifespan, I don't know if this makes sense as a pairing over the next couple of years. I almost think you get more out of this if you are San Francisco by restocking what you gave up for Lance, trying to restock some of what you gave up for Lance, and probably going in there and getting yourself a younger wide receiver as well as another part that you can add to your team. Will that wide receiver be as good? Odds are against it. But you would have somebody younger and you would have somebody that you pair with Lance to develop with him to where the wide receiver maybe hits that stride in his second or third year, which Lance in year three, year four, you would hope is up to that level as well. And I think what you don't want to get stuck with if you're San Francisco, especially kind of the way they run their offense there, I don't think you want to get stuck with a dud at quarterback. And I have no idea if they're really, how they were really into Lance. The whole process was just very strange. For a team that usually is pretty good with that stuff, the strategy was pretty strange. But I could see not wanting to get tied up with the tight end making $15 million a year. And you've got a lot of money that you've got invested in your left tackle. You probably are going to have more money invested in defense at some point. So I could see them kind of being like, you know, there's some other avenues that we would like to explore that we think we can use that money to build a better team overall, even if we end up with a little bit of a lesser player, maybe a lot of bit of a lesser player, that just kind of fits more of where they are as a franchise. So I think that's one of the things with it. The other thing at play here, too, is I think that a lot of teams were caught very off guard by the wide receiver market this year. I was, too. I did not expect Mike Williams to come in at 20 a year. I thought he'd probably get tagged, but the numbers would be less than that on a long-term deal. Certainly didn't expect Christian Kirk to come in at 18. There was an article this week, at least I think it was this week, that a coach was putting the blame on Kirk for wide receiver money. Like, come on, get a clue about the way this stuff works. Don't blame any player for that. But I think the numbers have crept up to where this is probably a budget buster based on what you were thinking before. You know, before this offseason, if you're San Francisco, you're probably thinking that he is going to come in somewhere between Sutton was at 15, Lockett at 17.25, you know, somewhere in that ballpark, you know, Galladay at 18. That's probably what you're thinking. And now once you have Williams get to 20, that really changes a lot of things up, as well as the Kirk at 18. And then I think the other issue that's at hand is you have Hill and Adams that have these monster size guarantees based on the length of their contracts. Their contracts are only 3 years long. And even if you factor in the old money in the Tyreek Hill deal, those guarantee numbers, the new money that's guaranteed to those players is kind of off the charts compared to everybody else. Everybody else, including Stephon Diggs, all those guys are in the ballpark of 13 a year, I think it is. Let me just put that in. Yeah, like 13, 5, 14 a year on the guarantee, somewhere in that frame. you know, with these other players, you're looking at like $18 million a year, $20 million a year. So if you look at those that way and you're looking to do a five-year deal, you're looking at a guarantee that would be in the $90 million to $100 million year range. You probably don't want to do that for him. You know, that's probably a concern. There's a lot of other factors at play here, too. So, you know, we're talking about defining the wide receiver market. His agent also represents a number of the players who are going to be landing these contracts that are pretty big in the near future. I believe the representation is the same for DK Metcalf. I believe it's the same for AJ Brown. And I think when you look at the three players, I think this is the one that's probably the hardest to kind of crack, but it's also the one that really sets the stage for the other two. Because if you can get Samuel to 23, well, you definitely should be getting Metcalf to 24, and you should be able to get AJ Brown to 25. So I think that's something that's at play here too. And I think when you go back and you look at the teams that you're dealing with, and I think that's important sometimes in doing some of these deals. You look for teams that do some of these deals that are bigger. And San Francisco did not used to be one of those teams. But I think as you look at them right now and you look at some of the deals they did make George Kittle the highest paid tight end in the NFL. I know that that's less money than obviously other positions, but they did make him the highest paid tight end in the NFL. You look at Trent Williams. Trent Williams probably didn't have another market. You know, we can see from Armstead. Armstead's got more of an injury history, but we can guess from Armstead where what he landed at to say Williams was going to be nowhere near 23 a year. San Francisco made him the highest paid left tackle in the history of the NFL at 23. So you've got the tight end, you've got the left tackle. Then on defense, you've got the linebacker where they made Fred Warner at 19. He was the first $19 million a year linebacker. You know, blew past C.J. Mosley at 17. So you've got three positions where they've gone above and beyond to get these contracts done. And that gives you something to lean on to be like, well, if you made this guy the top paid, and you made this guy the top paid, and you made this guy the top paid, why are you only offering me a contract here that pays him what Mike Williams is getting paid? So I think that's kind of what you want to do here. I think you have that. I think it's just a much better opportunity. If you look at Tennessee doesn't have that to fall back on. Look at the way Tennessee handled Derrick Henry. You know, they played that out to the franchise tag stuff. He ends up signing for $12.5 million, which is a good contract for running back, but it was not the McCaffrey Elliott money. You know, it was the notch below that. And you don't look at them at other positions. I mean, I'm just running through the stuff they've done here and see anything that really stands out. So I would look at that and say, okay, you know what? They're going to be more of a pain until you get kind of more data points that are out there to do anything. You know, the biggest one they did was probably the safety. I think they made him the highest paid at 14.1 many, many years ago. You know, that's probably the only one. And Seattle, you know, Seattle has been kind of the same thing. Seattle, so you had the Jamal Adams one. That's obviously something, and they had a lot invested in that through that trade, which is certainly regrettable at the moment. But if you look at the other players Seattle has done, they really haven't done the bank breakers. You know, it was basically Bobby Wagner on his second contract with that team, you know, third overall contract, second veteran deal. And then the Jamal Adams one, where Jamal Adams had all that leverage from those picks. So I think you want to get, if you're representing all these guys, you want to see San Francisco be the one that finds a way to get the deal done, even if the numbers don't necessarily work out to where, you know, he's the highest paid in the first year, highest paid in the second year. You know, Williams' deal didn't work like that either. He doesn't get to be the highest paid until he hits like the final year of the deal. So, you know, you might be able to do some stuff with that, but you need that number to be up there to basically keep this market rising. You know, right now, where you look at the wide receivers, you still do have kind of this group of receivers here where it's Godwin, Williams, Keenan Allen, DJ Moore, all in that $20 to $21 million a year range. Then you get to Diggs at 24, but that was with multiple years left. You have Hopkins, who really, in hindsight, I made such a mistake calling this one 27.25. I should have called this one for what it was, which is what I called it the whole time, was the 18. And then you got Adams and Tyreek Hill, which realistically are 22s and 24 or 25. You can do the Tyreek Hill one a couple of ways, but the Adams one is basically 22. So you've got a couple of these numbers here, and you can make a strong argument, well, there's no way he should be above Devontae Adams, but you can argue the same way that he's younger than him and the market has shifted as well, because you've got Diggs at 24, so that gives validity to Tyreek Hill at the 25 number, or whatever number he's at. So I think that's why you target San Francisco first of all the players. And you try to make that push there rather than, at some of the other spots around the league. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Then you go to the other spots and you see where you can go and see what happens there. But I think the most benefit comes from playing it this way. So that's kind of the way that I look at it. But don't think that he's going to force his way out because he said, I don't want to be here. If he gets traded this week, he gets traded because San Francisco has determined that there is more value in getting something in return for him than having somebody unhappy on the team and then having to deal with the contract issues for the next 1, 2, 3 seasons. So I think that's the way we really need to look at that, rather than the sky is falling approach, which has been very very noteworthy online, I think, this week. Denzel Ward signed a contract extension this week. That's a pretty big deal. $20.1 million a year. Does not get the big money up front that some of the other players got. Trails Jalen Ramsey pretty much till the end of the contract. I'm assuming that's why this deal got done. They just crept over the full guarantees. He gets 44.5 full. That's a little bit more than the prior market high was about 44.35 was Marshawn Lattimore. He gets a shade higher in full guarantees than Jalen Ramsey. Jalen Ramsey got 71.2. He'll get 71.25. Annual value 20.1 to 20. It's a 5-year deal for him. I'm kind of surprised that some of these corners are getting 5-year deals given the way that they typically kind of burn out. But we do have a number of players at this position getting five years. The Ward numbers reflect a couple of things. So number one is the over-the-top premium that we pay, especially when it's a player on an extension for someone who's like a top 5, top 10 pick. Denzel Ward is nowhere near the best cornerback in the NFL. I don't think there has been any metric, anything, any analysis of him that would say, oh, he's top corner in the NFL. I don't even know if he would go top 5. Now, from just the standpoint of doing business, I would say that Cleveland's right course of action is franchise tag. Like that kind of makes more sense. But I think given what their team is right now, it's a deal where you're not going to sit there and fight over money and say you should be on the same kind of deal as Tre'Davious White, who signed a deal that was kind of under market for where the market was going to be headed. You know, where I mentioned a team like San Francisco, you know, before saying that they're in a spot where you've got a new quarterback coming in and maybe the careers aren't going to parallel as well as you would like, given where his development might be and what the receiver is looking for in a contract and what you gave up to acquire him. you have a very different situation in Cleveland. Cleveland has no access to young talent the next 3 years because of what they traded away to get Deshaun Watson. Deshaun Watson is a clear win now quarterback. This is a clear win now team. It's a clear win now move. When you look at those things, it's not really worthwhile to fight over a couple of bucks here and there. You're not going to have other first round picks that you need to really extend. Let me just take a look at the Browns draft history here. Let me see if I'm missing anything, but you're not going to have any players coming in. So, I mean, you can defer cap charges because you are a team that is basically set in your knowledge of what your roster is going to be in terms of the contract stuff, because you can kind of earmark the kind of money that goes in free agency. What you can't do is know how good or how bad some of your best picks are going to be. But as things stand right now, they don't really have any players that you look at that are really going to break the bank, in that period of time. You know, Garrett's already signed. Mayfield's not getting a contract extension, so you can just throw him right off there. You didn't have a first-round pick in 2019. Willis, he'll get paid when he's due. But that's really it. You know, you look at that. So when it comes to the market and where these salaries go at the positions, teams like this are dangerous because they have a very different outlook than the majority of other teams in the league. And because of that, they end up upsetting the apple cart when it comes to salaries. Jacksonville is a team that kind of falls in that same category for different reasons. But they're a team like that. And sometimes when those deals get done, you have to take them with a little bit of a grain of salt or understand kind of why those deals are happening. And I'm pretty sure for the Browns, this is exactly why he gets to 20. It's just the situation they find themselves in and the contracts that they're going to have coming up and the access that they're going to have to talent. It's like you've got this guy that you know you'll pay him 20, or I mean, what's your other option? You let him walk in free agency just to go back into free agency to sign somebody at 15. Okay, yeah, there might be a benefit to that you get another corner at 15 at some point in time, and that gives you another $5 million to spend somewhere else. But you've got so many areas that you're going to have to fill in free agency. I think you just look at this and say, we're not going to go crazy over a couple of bucks here. We don't have alternative options. You know, again, in a perfect world, if a team has a first round pick, you don't do this deal now. You see the way the draft shakes out. Maybe you draft a corner in the first round, and then maybe you see how he plays. And if it looks like he's developing really well, maybe you have options to do franchise tag and then a contract extension if things don't go in the right direction, or you can trade and get some of those assets back. But you didn't have another option, so trading him this year wasn't going to be an option. And you don't have any options to draft at the position in the next couple of years. You know, at least not one of the type of prospects that's going to match up athletically. You may find a player. It's not like not having a first round pick means you will never find a player. Obviously, there's a lot of players that are available in every round of the draft. You have a second round pick this year. You have a third round pick. You might hit some players there. So it's not to say it can happen. It's just that your path to getting it is much less than before, and you're a win now team, and you don't fight over some of these things when you're a win now kind of football team. You know, you just kind of go for it and then let the chips fall as they may. But I think when you look at their situation, I think this probably made sense for them, even if it doesn't make sense for the way I think that you would independently evaluate this if you were any other team in the league or most other teams in the NFL right now. It probably wouldn't make sense. It definitely sets the stage for the next corners to probably get $21, $22 million a year, because I think you can find a lot of ways that you compare favorably to him, just not the biggest way, which is the fact that, you know, he's young and he was picked really high in the draft. That is hard to overcome, but it's, you know, you can usually overcome that, especially if it's you're talking about incremental increases in salaries. And I think that's probably what we'd be looking at with the next wave of free agents that comes through. So last week I had a question on positional spending, and I'm still going to actually hold off on that. I want to do a little bit more research into it. I have the basic numbers on it. you know, and I've run some studies on this before. Basically, the only position where the monetary investment is aligned with a record for a team really is quarterback. That's really the main thing. You know, you can get into categories like offense and defense, but it's almost like you got to pull certain things out, like the, you know, you pull the quarterback out of the situation for offense, you know, to see where teams go. But I think the right way to do it is I just need to come up with the right way to value a draft pick in there rather than the actual contract. And I think the way to do it is to apply kind of the methodology that we used for our draft charts. And by the way, we have a trade calculator that you can try there. It's under the interactive button on the menu on the website. But the actual contract values of the rookies themselves don't really show what that investment is and the expected return when a team selects that position. So I think I need to go and revalue those players based on where they were selected and kind of alter their annual values to get the true investment in the position. So I'll try to do that for next week, unless we have some cool draft stuff to talk about, which usually I'm not too up on. So it would really just be trade stuff. You know, that would be there. So I think I'll touch on that then. But what I wanted to talk about was the draft itself and the concept of kind of premium drafting. And this year, maybe that's going to fall by the wayside. Well, I don't know if most teams don't really follow this anyway, but this year it'll be maybe even more so because people talk about it being such a weak draft. And for the most part, most drafts end up very much the same, but you do have the occasional duds like 2013, and I think most will say that's where this one is kind of shaping up. But, you know, just some general stuff. So last year, I ran a study on allocations of your, basically, your capital on how you're going to build your roster, right? You can build your roster through the draft, or you can build your roster through free agency. And the goal of most teams is to obviously find a bunch of stars and then fill out the rest of the roster. Right? That's the general concept behind it. And there's a major salary cap benefit to drafting certain positions versus having to sign those positions in free agency. But there's also the fact that certain positions are simply not available in free agency. Now, there's different ways we can look at it. But again, where we're looking at the star factor, which is what you get into when you're talking about round one in the draft. Everyone that's drafting a player in round one thinks they're getting a star. Doesn't matter where you draft in round one, they all think they get a star. So you have to look to see, okay, I'm going to draft to get a quote-unquote star. If I draft one position over another, well, can I fill that void, especially when it's a need, somewhere else? So rather than take a short frame look like I did last year, and I'll publish this week at some point in time, I looked at the last 6 years. And I ran the numbers to see the top 20 paid players at every position. Obviously, top 20 means something different for a quarterback than it does for guards. But looked at the top 20 and looked at how many of those players were signed in free agency. Now, there's some leeway that I put in there based on when a player was signed, when he was extended, to say that, well, that still kind of counts as a unrestricted. You know, like a player like a Kirk Cousins, you know, I basically would look at him still as a UFA simply because he signed the 3-year deal and he signed the extension on top of that, but 90% of the time he would have signed a 5. So it's like his availability was simply because of free agency, not because of other stuff. There's other players where you get into that other extension and it's like, okay, well, you know, that's not really a free agent acquisition at that point anymore. So there's a little bit of leeway in that. But here are the numbers. So quarterback, only 14% of quarterbacks on average of the top 20 come via free agency. And those numbers in the last few years have been skewed pretty big by players like Brady and Rivers actually making it to free agency and switching teams in free agency. Most of those players are low-level guys, you know, Nick Foles, Teddy Bridgewater, that style of player, Case Keenum. So even though a couple of those players did make free agency, I would never look at any of those players as kind of game-changing players. Your second position is wide receiver. Only 21% of wide receivers have switched teams in free agency of your top players. They're almost all extended. And this is pretty steady. I looked at a six-year window, five-year window, three-year window, and a four-year window. I mean, it's been steady between 18 and 21%. So it's a position that gives you no access in free agency at all. Number three, left tackle, 23%. And again, that number has actually gotten worse and worse. We see more and more teams holding on to their left tackle. So for our three-year average, the last 3 years, is actually the lowest in the NFL. Only 13% of your top 20 come via free agency. Everyone else is extension or occasionally trade. So that makes left tackle highly valuable in the draft. Even though we can argue the impact of the left tackle maybe on the team, clearly this is a must-draft position. And I think if you look at where the players come from, it's probably a must-draft position in the first two rounds, maybe three rounds, you know, where you're aiming for a starter. So really, I look at those as your three ultra-premium positions in the draft. Then you get a little bit of a shift. A defensive tackle would be next, or interior defensive line. That'll count your defensive ends in the 3-4 kind of setting. So that's an average of 25%, but it's been a little bit more available in free agency recently. It's been about 28% in the last couple of years. But again, I would say that this is a position then that you could think of drafting. But I think when you look at where the talent comes from at this position, you look at this and say, okay, when I get to rounds two, when I get to round three, maybe even round four, what do I need to really look for? Where among this group, what are the talents that I need to look for? What are the traits that I need to find where I'm going to find starters at this position that I can kind of plug in? Where can I beat the system to do that? Next up, you have your pass rushers. This is a position that's been changing, though. So this is 28% over the last 6 years. But in the last last couple of cycles here, the last 4 years and three-year period, these numbers have come way up. So in the last 3 years, almost 40% of edge rushers have been able to be found on those top contracts in free agency. Last 2 years, it's been massive. So you've had a lot of movement at that position in free agency the last 2 years, and obviously there's a trade market that's developing, but trade market is almost like spending a draft pick, right? Because you're giving something away to trade for those players. But I think this is a position, obviously, that you do want to look very high in the draft, but I think at least you can start to make a case now in the current NFL that you may be able to find pass rushers in free agency if you decide that there is a more premium position that you're comparing it with those top picks. You know, I think given these numbers, I'd almost say that quarterback, wide receiver quarterback, we know you'd have to take over it. I almost think wide receiver might break that tie. The only thing I will say is that the pass rushers, pretty much your top pass rushers all come top three rounds. Most probably top two rounds, whereas some other positions, you do get a lot of diamonds in the rough. I think with the pass rushers, the teams basically find those players before they fall, you know, become the Cameron Wake types. You don't get many of those. But it is a position that has increasing availability. Running back is at 28%. That's kind of a oddball one. The reason running back is, I think, where it's at is simply because nobody touches the position in free agency. You do get players who are available. They just don't end up signing for much money. I think all teams are kind of scared off by it. And the market itself is not that big. So that's kind of a weird one. I think your premium on that actually comes from just saying find some volume late in the draft, because free agency is not really an option. But I think everybody knows that at this point. I don't think this is a saying, well, you got to draft one high. Linebacker, 31%. And that number has gotten much higher in recent years. It's up to 37, and we've seen a lot more players now that salaries have gone up there, switch positions. Tight ends, 37%. This is consistent across the board. So tight end is a position where you probably can fill that one in free agency. Centers, same deal, 40%, pretty straight across the board. So you will always have access to highly paid centers in free agency. Safety, 40%, 41%, pretty much straight across the board. Position you obviously can fill in free agency. Right tackle, same thing, 41%. Very consistent, right across the board. So I think when you look at these positions here, I would group all these positions at 36 and above. So the ones that I mentioned here, tight end, center, safety, right tackle, and say, all right, there is no way I'm spending a first round pick on any of these positions. Definitely not a top 10 pick. Like that's insanity. There are so many players available at these positions that I would look at this and say, okay, where and how do I get better? If I'm saying that there is a safety worth a top 10 pick, you know, am I better off drafting that safety? Or am I better off drafting the edge, who maybe isn't as a great of a prospect as the safety on a piece of paper, but I can still go and buy a really good safety for probably $10 million a year in free agency. And I have my edge rusher through the draft that we'll see how he works out. Maybe he won't be a $30 million pass rusher, but maybe he'll be a $17 million pass rusher. Maybe he'll be a $20 million pass rusher. You know, or my other option is I can get the safety in the draft who would have cost me 15 in free agency, or maybe he'll be the same as a $10 million player. But let's say I get the $15 million safety, you know, basically the top of the line safety. I didn't really save much money by doing it. Now I have to go find an edge rusher. And while those numbers obviously have come up in recent years, you know, the odds are against me finding them. And even if I do find them, now I have to pay $20 million for that player. So in the end, you end up spending significantly more on the position and probably getting lesser players, lesser value, lesser impact to your team overall, because we kind of get this very myopic focus on, well, you know, I graded this guy, I don't know, a 85, and I'm grading that pass rusher, I'm grading that wide receiver only at a 80. So I got to take the safety. And you take all the other things into account, how is your team going to get better? The way to build your best 53-man roster is to let somebody else take that safety, even if that safety is going to be an all-pro, and get your guy who's maybe going to be a borderline pro bowler and go and buy yourself a Pro Bowl safety. I mean, you look at right now, what would it cost you to get a Pro Bowl wide receiver? A couple of second round picks and $24 million a year. Now, granted, that's again the top of the line, but I could go and get a top of the line safety for 14 or 15. That's $10 million less. So, you know, I think that's the way that you have to look at it, because at least the draft gives you access to possibly getting the top wide receiver, a top wide receiver. safety, you know, you have access to those types of players otherwise. And then the easiest positions to fill in free agency, guard, about 50%. Been pretty consistent. That number's increased. So don't draft interior offensive line high. And most teams don't, but don't do it. Find those expensive positions that you can't get in free agency and take your shots on those players in the draft. Even if it's not necessarily quote-unquote best player available, it's the best way to build a team. And then the position that is actually the most likely to have top talent switch is the corners. 51% have switched, and that number is 55 in the last 3 years. So lots and lots and lots of corners going to free agency. Are they the tippy top players? No, they're not the tippy top. But it's just one small notch below that. So that tells you that even though those players are pretty good, they're not good enough that the teams that drafted them are saying, well, we need to stick with these players at all costs. Because what did they find? Well, they found that there's alternative routes to filling that corner position and that there's more important positions to pay up for. And, you know, when you want to build a cornerback room, and maybe one of those players, you want to be a superstar, you know, to where I think I have a star. I think I've drafted a star. Yeah, I've done a bunch of stuff on that rather than rehashing that. But, I mean, you do need to build a room. But you can begin that room also in free agency. So I just think we need to keep these things in mind. And nobody does. Certainly on ESPN, you don't hear about it during the draft or NFL Network. You know, you'll see some random player and they'll talk about him being a unicorn and, you know, great. And he's going to give this meanness and this tenacity and he's going to do all these things and he's going to change the fortunes of a team. Even though you go, when was the last player at that position to really change the fortunes of a franchise? You know, the evaluation is, how do we build a 53? And what are the avenues in which we do it? What are the areas that we can fill through street players? You know, your lower level draft picks and your players you can claim and sign and try to develop. What are the ones we can develop in free agency? What are the ones we must develop high in the draft? And I think when you look at these things and, you know, when you look at the longevity of some of these positions as well. You know, your quarterbacks, if they're good, they last forever. If a left tackle is good, they pretty much last forever. Defensive tackles last a pretty long time too. Edge rushers, they last for a while as well. I don't know if you get as long of a career out of them. I think the peak impact on those players is more than the defensive tackle. But I think you can make an argument at least, you know, to the closeness of some of that stuff. But I think when you look at these, I almost think that you take quarterback and left tackle and you're almost putting that in a class of its own. And then you're going to put wide receiver, interior and edge, and that's going to be the next group. Wide receiver, I think, being the most important to draft from that group. And you can argue with the other two. I think with the other two, you're probably arguing more about the impact than the cap benefits and the other stuff. And, you know, then I think you're just grouping all these other positions and being like, you know, whatever. You know, it's got to be a magical reason to take one of these players. I mean, the only reason you should be taking really any of these positions in the first round is if there are none of those other premier positions left. Like you don't have a first round grade, even a high second round grade on any of the other positions. So that's the only time you probably should be doing it. You know, the other thing I'd comment about the draft, and this was something that, you know, it's been alluded to in other studies, and Brad and I looked at it, and, you know, we discussed it a bit in the book too. There is actually kind of a little bit of a weird phenomenon that occurs in the draft where the picks that are taken high in the second round are often better than the picks that are taken late in the first round. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that, but I think one of the big takeaways that I have, and maybe this is not the right takeaway, but I think it is, I think when you look at the teams that draft at the end of the first round, we have a shift. They're all playoff teams. So the teams that are the worst teams in the league, they're all drafting quote-unquote best player available. They're drafting for whoever they think is the best possible prospect to throw out on the field because they're just filled with holes pretty much left and right. When you get to the latter part of that draft, I think you see more and more teams begin drafting for need, or they draft for luxury. You know, a team like the Chiefs taking a running back is probably them looking at it like, well, it's a luxury. Like, we didn't really need anybody, and we could use an upgrade at this position, and maybe we can find a role for him in our offense. Like, hopefully he can catch the ball out of the backfield and be a big, have a big role that way. There's other teams where, you know, you look at it and you look at a team that struggled against the run in the playoffs. It's like, God, we need a linebacker. You know, we didn't get him in free agency. We need a guy. We need a thumper in the middle. We need someone that's going to do that. Or, you might be desperate for help at corner. The top prospects are gone, and you're probably looking at some of the wrong things in the players. And you're reaching for players based on certain traits that maybe in that part of the draft don't really pan out. You know, you're looking for like best athlete available when at that point in time you should be looking for a more well-rounded player at the position versus the might be the best athlete. But in any event, you're trying to fill a need. And with the exception of probably linebackers, maybe guards, centers, safety. That's probably it. I think, you know, and it's those lower positions. Maybe a couple right tackles too. You know, those are the positions that typically take a season to develop. So you're looking for immediate help and you're taking a corner. That corner is not going to give you immediate help as a rookie. You're taking a wide receiver. He's probably not going to give you help as a rookie. Defensive tackle, definitely not going to give you help as a rookie. Pass rusher, probably not. You know, he'll be a situational player. Maybe he'll throw up a bunch of sacks, but he's not going to be on the field probably enough to give you that impact that you need to get over the top. So it's like you're drafting for need, so you're probably reaching. And you're taking players who probably should be drafted in the second round, but based on need, you're taking them in the first. And you have to realize that in the NFL, so I posted something on roster turnover this week. I know I mentioned it last week in the podcast. And you know, let me just pull it up real quick. I'm not going to go off on that whole thing. You can read it over if you want it over thecap.com. If you look at these teams, the average return on a team is about 55% of the roster in 1 year, about 35% over 2 years. So you don't have big retention in the NFL. You are always churning your roster. So there is no position that you can look at. Nah, I shouldn't say no position. There's almost no position that you can look at and say, we're set. The only positions that you can look at and say we're set is if you've got the star quarterback and he's under 32, 33. And you have a left tackle who's a really good left tackle who's also under that same age, you know, or maybe under 31. Those two positions, I would say that you could say you're set at those two positions. But that's it. You know, I would say anywhere else, you can always upgrade. You know, the good wide receiver today, is probably not going to be a good wide receiver tomorrow. The good corner today is definitely not going to be a good corner tomorrow. You know, the good running back today, definitely not going to be a good running back tomorrow. The good pass rusher today, probably going to have trouble staying healthy. He's going to start to regress more into a situational player. So don't look at your current roster construction and say, oh, I'm set. Like, I just signed this guy, I'm set. I wouldn't even look at it like I've got a young guy and say I'm set. Because there's always contract headaches. So you always want to have as much good coming in to replace the potential good out. You know, good that you can't fit because of salary cap. Good because you can't fit because of your budget. Good that you just don't want to fit because you don't think they're going to be good for much longer. So you want to have that influx of talent that comes in to replace them. So what if you lose a year to development? Who cares? Now, how much better would the Raiders have been when they traded Khalil Mack away if they had addressed another pass rusher high in the draft? I don't believe they did. Maybe they did. But would they have been in better shape? I'm sure they would have been in better shape. Now, instead of having to go and reach for one the minute they traded him, you know, the year after they traded him because they didn't have anybody. So you want to have these players that come in there, and it only helps you with the contract, right? When players are holding out, they're holding out because their situation is optimal at that point for them to do that. Because you're desperate to retain those players. Now, you're not as desperate to retain those players when you have a pipeline of younger talent that can replace them. You know, if the Browns had another good corner, maybe you don't have to spend $20.1 million to keep Ward. You know, if you have those players, but you have to focus on the draft in that manner. Even when you're drafting late, don't ever look at the draft to fill a need. If you have to fill a need that's a short-term need, fill it in free agency. Well, we don't have the cap space for it. Well, that's your problem. Figure out a way to do it. If not, plug in a later pick, let them develop, find a cheap veteran to pair them with, you know, in free agency. Don't reach on players that you shouldn't be reaching on. You know, and then letting some of these premium positions drop to the second round where they land on some of the bad football teams. So that's just my two cents on some of the stuff when it comes to the draft, and you watch how that plays out. But this one is going to be a little different. Just the draft doesn't have the feel of like a normal draft. So we'll see next week. You know, and hopefully, I guess it depends on what day I record to see where all the draft capital ends up. And we'll see if there's like a lot of trades and stuff like that, and maybe go over that stuff. So, all right, let's get into the Q&A. I know I had a couple email things, so let's start in our email this week. Not sure if this one's a podcast one or not, from Thomas. Is there a correlation between greater retention of players, the backbone players, starters, and improving your record compared to the previous year? No, there was no real correlation. Well, yeah, I shouldn't say that. I looked at overall record, and I didn't have a chance to just run the how much the record actually improves by, you know, figuring out what's kind of the fair way to do that. But in terms of overall record, no, it doesn't impact that you have teams that come back and that are necessarily means they're going to be great or that they're going to be poor. You know, a lot of times when you bring back the same team, you know, that players or other teams are kind of ready for you. They've done a better job preparing. So I think that kind of plays into it. But I'll try to look into that. But my initial gut feeling on that is there is nothing there. And I think for the most part, you want to be able to change your teams around. Let's see. David, just a reminder on investment and position. Like I said, we're gonna roll around to that again, and I'll come up with a couple of ways maybe we can do that. Let's see. CMB. What the heck is going on with Geno Smith's contract? What the heck are the Seahawks doing this offseason in general? Seems like there's delusion about the quality of the roster. I have no idea what Seattle's doing. Seattle's offseason kind of screams of overconfidence in the roster and this feeling of Pete is right that we need to be this run first something kind of team, that this was not let Russ cook, that was all nonsense, that we didn't need to play that style of offense. We were at our best when Russ was hurt last year, and we had this defense playing really well, and we've got a lot of parts on the defense that we're happy with, and we are going to get this tough physical ground game going next year, and we're going to have a plug-in quarterback that can throw the ball down the field to a couple of our receivers, and we're going to compete. I don't get it at all. It's a team that should be rebuilding, rebuilding, and kind of waiting out some of their contracts at this point and seeing what they can do to move forward, and I have no idea. As for Geno Smith's contract, it's, you know, people were making a big deal that the contract was not approved by the league. Those things do happen from time to time. More often than not, I see that with rookies. Usually what happens is that a team will, you might sign a undrafted player, not realize he's undrafted, you sign him for a year, then you got to redo the contract for three. You might make an error in a calculation or some language or something that screws up the contract, has it be disproved by the league, and you know, you just got to refile it. And I have a feeling that this was a pretty... pretty similar error like that. Who knows? Maybe they just grabbed the boilerplate thing and had a wrong year in it. Because they had it fixed within a day, whatever the issue was there. I have no idea why they're doing a deal that's worth, I think they said base value 3.5. I don't have the actual numbers on it. It's only 500,000 guaranteed. So I'm going to guess he's going to get cut if he doesn't win a starting job. But I don't know. I don't really get what they're doing there at all. But I'm sure that this was just a very generalized mistake. You know, maybe they had some kind of incentive that couldn't be in there, because I'm sure there's a lot of incentives in this deal. So they may have had something that can't be in there. So I'm sure it was something that was pretty innocent and just kind of got flagged. Let's see. From Cameron, over the last several weeks, months, my knowledge of the NFL team building and analysis has improved greatly. Thanks to your podcast. Thank you very much. Thank you for providing this research, fans like myself. Question is, can you explain how teams analyze positional value in the draft and maybe some of the factors teams abide by when drafting prospects? For instance, I've been an Eagles fan for 20-some years. It's apparent Howie's front office place emphasis on tackle, D-line, wide receiver, but less emphasis on linebacker, safety, tight end, interior, maybe corners in the first. Eagles also appear reluctant to draft older players. Imagine most teams have tendencies like this, but we don't hear about them as much. I'm not sure exactly on that. So in Philadelphia's case, they're obviously very analytically driven. So I think that what you're picking up on there is the same stuff that I'm talking about here. New England for years was always a draft the trenches team. You know, draft offensive line, draft defensive line. That's kind of what they would look for. Steelers, I think they're a team, if you look sometimes, and obviously they do silly stuff with the running backs and stuff, but you know, they've looked for guys with certain athletic scores, I think, that they aim the draft for. So you can look at some teams like that. Sometimes I think where the general manager's background comes from dictates sometimes the way that they lean. One of the things right now is it's harder to gain kind of an appreciation, I think, for teams themselves and the way they do it. You know, you point to Philadelphia. Philadelphia's got this very long history that's basically uninterrupted with the exception of those couple Chip Kelly years. So you've got years and years and years and years of draft data. You know, you have Seattle, who you can look at and say, Seattle obviously doesn't put any kind of premium on the positions, but they put a premium on moving down out of the first round. They're one of the teams that probably does it right. They look at those late picks in the first round and they look at it like it's more advantageous for us to be picking in the second round rather than, you know, reaching on a first round player that we're trying to plug and play. So, you know, that's a team with a long history. Baltimore's a team with a long history. So you can look at some of the things those teams do. Pittsburgh. But a lot of the other teams, their general managers are in and out. Now, like, we'll laugh about the Jets and how much they take all these defensive linemen. That span multiple general managers. It just so happened that that's the way that that worked out. It's not like it was a magic New York Jets philosophy. It was just the way those guys graded them. But, I mean, you could look at Maccagnan, and Maccagnan very clearly was a... The scouting background came out. You know, he was very much like, well, I've got grades on these players, and in my mind, this guy should be the top player in the draft. Like, Leonard Williams was a player who he looked at, and I think he was just like, this guy should be the top player in the draft. What year was Leonard Williams drafted? 2015, I think. Let me just look to see who was in that draft that year. Let me just look to see the Leonard Williams draft, just to give an idea on that. So this is a draft that goes Jameis Winston, Marcus Mariota, Dante Fowler, Mari Cooper, Brandon Scherff. And he's looking at this like, this guy is number one in the draft. He should be number one on the board. There's no way the Buccaneers can take him over Winston or Mariota. There's probably no way the Jaguars should be taking, if for as much as Fowler didn't work out there, you know, should be taking Williams above a Fowler. Raiders shouldn't be taking Williams above Amari Cooper, in my mind. Washington, yeah, they could have gone in a different direction. So, you know, I think that is the, you'll see that with teams too. I think what you saw in Oakland or Vegas, whatever, I always refer to them as Oakland, when, you know, you mentioned them in this email here, I didn't mention that, but I don't even know if they were placing position over raw talent, though I do think they do that. I think what used to happen there is you had this weird combination. You had the ultimate draft scout who was now getting the opportunity to actually have real direct input on decision-making for a football team. And then you had a coach in Gruden, who was very specific about, we need to fill these particular needs in the draft, and we're going to show so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. We move those players off team, but we're going to fill those spots in the draft. And I think they did these reaches because they would fall in love with prospects that were probably what they would refer to as like a hidden gem. You know, if this was like, if you were back doing a show on ESPN or NFL Network, it would be like, you know, the hidden gems available, you know, my secret superstars who are going to be there. Well, now I'm getting the opportunity to pick them. And while every other analyst is saying, these are second and third round picks, you know, the Raiders might jump on that player in the first round. And I think that was just a combination of who was running the team at the time. So, you know, I think it's tough to see, and it's tough to fundamentally realize. I mean, I think the only thing that we know is that almost every single team in the league clearly puts a premium on quarterbacks. And you see that by quarterbacks even who get drafted late in the first round. You see quarterbacks who jump in the second round, who don't belong in the second round. They're reaches. And again, you can argue because of the premium of the position, but most of those players haven't worked out. And I think if you go and you study the draft, I think you have to start to wonder, are certain positions, maybe because of that premium, being pushed too high? Or is this, again, about value? Is it, you know, what are the reasons why some of the players get pushed where they do get pushed in there? So I think that those are all interesting studies. You know, and the teams, you know, it varies a lot, but there's so much turnover in the front offices, it's hard to get a read on a lot of them. This is a book question. All right, I'll try to answer this. I don't think this is for podcast. This one's also not for the podcast. I'll fix that. There's a dead cap number for Brandon Cooks. That doesn't belong there. Steven says, I was watching a documentary about the 85 draft, and Bill Frelick had a contract like this. The Rabbi Trust, how it works, does it transfer? Is there a year dollar cap charge? This would fix the stigma of NFL athletes going broke. Why is it not more common? So I'm not exactly sure what that was, but I would imagine it's a a lifetime payment annuity type of thing. In the old NFL days, it's like the Wild West of contracts, right? There's no real set systems. It's all very different. When you go back, one of the reasons the original USFL, not the one that's on TV now that has like 50 people watching, the original USFL would attract some high talent college players. And they looked at that as a way to kind of steal them from the NFL. And what they were doing were giving them contracts that were crazy compared to what the NFL was doing at the time. But those were deals that were all set up like that. They were all set up like annuities. They were all set up like the Bobby Bonilla Mets kind of stuff. You know, you would get, I'm just making up these numbers, but it's like you'll get $40,000 a year while you're playing football. You'll get $60,000 a year for the next 10 years after that. And then we're going to pay you $2 million a year for the next 10 years. I mean, there were some, you know, oddball things. None of that stuff is allowed nowadays. It's that was all gone, I think, in 93, probably before that. But that stuff was all gone. So you have to pay the players over a, right now it's an 18 week. So it's over 36 weeks. It used to be over 18. Now they deferred that payment to the next year. So teams pay you over 36 weeks. You do come up with a signing bonus schedule. Signing bonuses are typically paid off within, on an extension, I think it's 2 calendar years. On a regular contract, it's 1 calendar year. And, you know, it's all negotiable and the way that those work out. So, you know, there's no ability to do these things where you give somebody a plot of land in Texas, you're giving them a piece of a company, you're giving them, nobody got ownership into a team, but, you know, whether it's talking Brady, looking to get ownership of the Miami Dolphins, you know, there's none of that went on and, or could go on nowadays. And if you did, anything that was of value would land on the salary cap, and that would make it, you know, not realistic to do. So, yeah, I'm assuming that's what that is. I'm not familiar specifically with that one, but yeah, there used to be some old things you could read about that were just kind of wacky contract stuff. All right, let's take a look through Twitter here. Let's see. I asked for questions now, but I know that there were a couple. Here we go. Could you talk about the Brady restructure? How did the Bucs create $9 million on a contract with a year left? Is it void years? Does this impact their ability to re-sign him? So it doesn't impact their ability to re-sign him. So the way they created nine, I didn't update this, but I'm pretty sure what they did here. He already had 4 void years on the contract, or 3 void years, I think. How many does Brady have? Let's see. I think Brady has 3 voids. Yeah, he has 3 voids. So what they did is, I believe, they restructured his salary down to the minimum, which I think is $1.12 million this year. So they converted all his P5 and his roster bonus to a signing bonus, and they prorated that over 4. And then I think what they did is they put conditionals on his LTBEs. So last year what they did is they gave him these incentives that he could reach for playoffs, Super Bowl, completion percentage, maybe yards per completion, touchdowns, something like that. You know, a couple of different things. And what they did is, to make sure they wouldn't count against the cap, they put a team qualifier. So it was last year, I think it was that the team had to show improvement in rushing yards. It was like the easiest offensive category to improve in because they're kind of a sucky rushing team the year before. So it was the most likely thing to see improvement. So that made them so they didn't count against the cap. They didn't have those same qualifiers in there for 2022 because they were just worried about the cap for 21. So I'm sure what they did is they went in there and they put that qualifier or something very similar to it that would be likely to be hit, but it will not count against the cap. So basically they knock all that stuff out there and it'll reduce his cap hit by like $9.13 million, I think. But I didn't update it. I'll get around to updating it to see. But I think that's all they did. But they can still do his contract next year, but I would imagine that he will want to, become a free agent. I would think that's what he's going to want to do. All right, let's see a couple more, and then we'll get done. General thoughts on the Jets trading for Debo. I wouldn't be against it. Yeah, I would have rather they had, even though he's older. I feel weird saying it because Tyreek Hill's not a best of people. Talent-wise, what he can do, I think I'd rather have him there. I think right now there's going to be a lot of expectations on Debo because of some of the gadgety stuff he did, and that gadgety stuff is not going to carry over. So I don't know. I'm not sure if you're getting a true number one or if you're going to end up with overpaying for what amounts to a 1A type, and maybe that's okay. He would upgrade the team. They need people to pair with Wilson. Wilson's a rough prospect as well. So you might be able to make those same arguments, but if you were willing to do Hill, he should have there should be more of a match over the longer term, I would think, with Wilson than Hill would have had. So I don't know. See how it works out and see what they give up. You know, the one thing is that I think since that package was pretty much publicly out there about what they would give up, I do think it becomes harder for them to make this trade if you could come away with giving up a number one. That probably doesn't look too good. So that might actually be a little bit of a trouble here too. Zach says, which position do you think is next up for major market correction all of the 2020 corners? Stagnant positions. So let's just take a look and see. So it's not tight end. That's going to get blocked in by Kittle. Left tackle's not going anywhere. Right guard. Your guards are going to jump. I don't know by how much, though. And that's not really a market correction. That's going to be one individual player. Your linebackers already jumped. You know, I think if there's a position that's probably due, it's probably going to be the interior defensive lineman. I think they've been blocked for some time because of Donald's contract. It's like all your top contracts in the league were signed in 2021, 2022, and this contract was signed in 2018. Now, I'm not saying that you get the production out of this position that really should see salaries spike up and up and up, but I do think if you look at this and you say that, well, you know, this market has been in place since 2018, that there's probably something that needs to move up. And obviously that's going to be Aaron Donald getting another contract. So I think if you were going to keep an eye out, I would say that's probably the position that'll move forward. In large part, that's just because all these other positions already have moved forward. So I think that'll be the one. Potential O-line cap casualties the Raiders could sign. Oh, I don't know. I haven't looked that close. Usually what I do is after the draft, you look at who's been selected in the first two rounds, and then you realize who's on the chopping block. You know, the Bears, Washington last year made some moves after that. Those are the kind of teams that do that. I don't have the numbers right in front of me. Let me just see real quick if I can pull up some offensive linemen. I don't really have it in a good format right here to do that. So I need to really just build this by team. But I think that's what you have to look at, is we look at it that way. So maybe next week I'll talk a little bit about that. I'll try to put together a little bit of a table so I can run through those. Matthew says, how do you stop players from refusing to play out the rookie contract before allowing them to negotiate a new deal? Well, there's a lot of fines that come with it. If you're in the fifth year of your rookie deal, you're fined, I think it's $40,000 a day, and you're fined 1 week's salary, and you're on an option year at that point. 1 week's salary for every preseason game that you miss. That's pretty high number. If you're in your fourth year, let's say your second round pick or something, you could forfeit some of your old signing bonus money. You still are subject to the, $40,000 or so fines, which adds up pretty quick. And on top of that, you lose a season towards free agency. So, there are financial things in place, and the league has this stuff for, I think it's only for veterans that they can't rescind the fines. I'm not sure on that. I don't pay as much attention to those little nuances on that, but I think that's just with the veterans, that part of it. But for the most part, I think you just kind of have to put your foot down and say, well, this is what it is. Teams have allowed this concept of the hold-in to go on now because they're interested in re-signing the players. So they've done these deals where they allow them to kind of sit on the sidelines so they don't incur any fines and they don't get anyone upset, but they don't play. They don't practice. They just kind of stand there. I don't like the hold-in at all. I kind of understand, I guess, the purpose of it, but I don't really like that at all. Certainly from the team perspective, I don't like it. But I think the main thing is just exerting whatever leverages that they have and pointing those out to the players and then kind of saying, well, you either play or you don't get paid. It's not like you can just sit out and just be done with it. And you can't do the things. One of the reasons why those holdout rules are in place now about the accrued seasons, they don't want teams or players to basically do the bit where they will sit out for almost their entire fourth year and then show up to play the last, I think it's week 10 is the cutoff. So, the last 7-8 weeks of the year and then become a free agent. So, they basically are going to say, well, you're probably not going to be a free agent. And if it's the option year where you would still get to be a free agent, well, the financial losses wouldn't be worthwhile for you to have done that. You're not making that up in a new contract. So I think they have things in play. I think we just don't talk about it. It just the over-the-top news on it is just player X is unhappy, asks for trade. Oh, no, what happens now? And what happens now is nothing. Without a first-round 5-year contract and needing at least one redshirt year, will a team have enough time to develop Willis before he gets a second contract? Sure. I think that teams will know for certain after 3 years if the guy has it or doesn't have it. And that could just mean having potential. The franchise tag is always an option. There are creative extensions you can do with players who haven't played well, but for the most part, if you talk about a player like that and you say, okay, rookie year is just a total loss and the second year is really going to be like a rookie year. So, for almost any player in the league, that means year three should be a fundamentally strong year for the player. And if there's nothing for them to show, there's probably a problem at that point. But you still have that fourth year to develop them, and then you just kind of decide after that what you want to do. If you give them away, give them away. If not, offer a fair market contract. By fair, and you can easily check fair market because, you can look at players like a Mariota and Winston and those types and see where they went in free agency. And, you know, you've got the numbers right in front of you. You know, the only question that you would have is, can you convince them to come back? And, you know, if you're confident that they'll be a good player, you know, or could be a good player, you know, you can give him a starting job one more time to do something with it. But I think it's still enough time to find out if they're a competent player or not and kind of go from there. Let's see. Football guy, you hear a lot of times that the fifth-year option for quarterbacks is overrated because if the quarterback is good, they will already have a big contract before the fifth year. Doesn't any extension go into effect after the fifth year anyway, so the fifth year is still cheap? So, yeah. So, it's not like it's a meaningless year. The fifth year is going to run anywhere from like 18, right now, I think it's 18 to 23. So, that's significantly less money than if the player was a free agent, right? Because if you sign a quarterback, let's say it's a star quarterback, $40 million a year, just to give and take a little bit. So if you sign him to a four-year deal, you know, you're paying him, you know, 4 by 40, you know, $160 million for 4 years. You know, that's an actual $40 million a year contract. He's going to be free agent in 5. If you sign a player to a four-year extension, you know, worth $40 million a year, you're going to get that 160 plus the, let's call it 23 baked in. So that's going to bring your five-year cost to 36.6, you know, versus the team that doesn't have that. Let's say they had to do a 40 for five. Let's say it's just a question of, you know, doing the 5 years. So, I mean, basically you're looking at $200 million versus 183 in actual payments. So, yeah, obviously there is a value to having that fifth year. I don't think the value of that fifth year, though, is so high that you need to be trading future number one picks or solid number two picks to get that player. Now, if you want to get the player because you are worried that you're going to miss out on him, like, let's say I need to get a player at 28 because I'm afraid that the team picking number 35 is going to take him and I don't pick until 40. Okay, I get it that you're moving up to get the quarterback. But if you're moving up only because, well, I know he'll be there at 40, but God damn it, I want that fifth year option. Well, that's stupidity. That's stupidity. Because you have the transition tag you can use. And the fifth year option number may end up being the same as the transition tag. You have the franchise tag you can use. Yes, is the franchise tag a higher number? It is. Is the franchise tag going to be lower than the annual value you're going to pay somebody? It is. You know, it's kind of like a middle ground number. So while, yeah, you don't get the best of the world, I would rather pay up. Because look, if I'm going to be paying $40, $50 million a year for my quarterback, I'm going to be happy with who I picked. I'm not going to care about the option year that much or not. I would much rather have a quarterback who's worth $45 million and I actually pay him $45 million a year because his contract ran out or whatever number that works out. Let's say it works out to be $42 million with a franchise tag thrown in, $42 million a year, and I have my second round pick versus I'm giving up a future second round pick so I can get my quarterback at an effective value of 40 instead of 43. I mean, I'd rather have the second round pick than have that option year. And sometimes that option year sucks because you have to opt into it early. And sometimes it's still questionable for the player. Like, would you be better off if you were Carolina? Sam Darnold wasn't on an option? Sure. If you were Cleveland, would you be better off if Baker Mayfield wasn't on an option? Sure. You know, those are players who never would have gotten the franchise tag. You know, you would have just offered him a low contract to continue as the quarterback. So, yeah, you know, I think in some senses it's overrated. I think we make too much out of it. But it's not like there's no value to it at all. I mean, there is a value, but I think it's only valuable if it comes naturally. you shouldn't be jumping up just to get that 50 year. And I have heard a couple people say that, and I disagree with that completely. Dave says, have you ever equated salary cap to draft pick compensation? X percent of the cap equals X amount in draft compensation. Basically, Brock Osweiler situation. So you can. There isn't a hard number on it right now. We've done that. We've done a couple things on it that we've looked at where you look at trades and you start to kind of get what's the value that's placed on a trade where you can kind of try to get the money aspect out or taken out from it. But I there's probably not enough data to make a definitive statement on it. And it's hard to, untangle some of these trades, including the Osweiler one. You know, Osweiler had a lot of moving parts. So it's sometimes very hard to do that. You know, it's like the Stafford one. Like there were a lot of moving parts in there to where you say, well, where was that first round pick just for the Goff contract? Or is there, you know, other stuff involved? You know, that makes it tough to do. Mike says, but I may have got this wrong, but the way guaranteed contracts work for how the Packers ownership is structured, how do they raise tens of millions, put in escrow, all their operating funds and everything else? I mean, they operate like a team. You know, they have money, they have a budget. The only thing they probably can't do, I would guess, is, you know, if something crazy happened, like the Watson contract, let's say the Watson contract had to happen to a team like Green Bay and it was an out of nowhere decision, the way that the Browns thing was. Maybe the Packers couldn't do that. I'm not really even sure, but I think in the sense of general football business, I'm sure they have more than enough set aside every year to do stuff in the framework of regular NFL contracts. And that's probably one of the reasons why they don't do guarantees on that team. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why they only do signing bonuses as their guarantees for just about everybody. But you know, I think they could function just like anyone else. They just couldn't do the emergency plea to ownership to give us more money to do something. And I don't think that even happens too often in the NFL. Would like to know how much you think the salary cap space given to teams will rise next season. How do you think this will affect decisions and towards the future? So I think next year it'll be in like the 225-ish range, give or take a little bit, maybe 230, maybe 220. There's some stuff that has to get paid back to the cap still from COVID. There's some benefits that have to get paid back to the players that they deferred. So there's some stuff there. I think your big rise comes in 2024, whatever that number may be. And if you look at the way the smarter teams in the NFL are functioning right now, you can see how they've deferred a lot of cap charges to 23 and 24 when they expect those numbers to come up. Can you explain how a hold-in would work in 2022? Seems to me people love the idea of players holding out, but if teams are willing to get uncomfortable, I don't see how a player ends up on top. Hold-in simply works that you show up and you go, yeah, my back is stiff. My calf is sore. My ankles are bothering me. You know, I'm not going to go practice. You know, I'm here, but I'm not healthy. And that's basically the gist of it. I don't think there's anything more more to it than that. You know, basically you are going to hold in during off-season stuff, and the other times you're going to hold in is if your agent is basically telling you that they are actively negotiating. Otherwise, you're going to hold out, and then that's a different ballgame if that happens. Final draft thoughts. Will the recent mega contracts for receivers boost the number taken in the first round for the long term? As in, do you think more teams trade up for receivers rather than quarterbacks? As a fan of teams linked to wide receiver in the first round, what are your expectations for standard first round receiver? Your expectations in the first round, the receivers in the first round have been pretty hit or miss more than other positions. So it's a weird one because clearly there's a premium on the position that you have to take your shots on. I think the league has not done a good job of necessarily evaluating or being able to separate the high-level athletic traits that I don't know, I guess exist for players versus what makes a good football player. I don't know if that makes any sense. We look at some of the top receivers and go, well, you know, they're off the charts in X, Y, and Z when it comes to athleticism and size. And so we kind of look at those players now and we maybe make players get too high up there. But I think when you have players who maybe you have a couple of guys who are so gifted, like the Tyreek Hills and Justin Jeffersons and stuff like that, where there's really nobody that can cover them. Their ability is that good. But I think sometimes when you have players who are never challenged, against better corners in college or systems or whatever, sometimes that makes it hard to translate that stuff to the pros. And I think that's probably where a lot of stuff, you know, you kind of get lost in. Maybe it has to do with the offenses that they run too. You know, if college has simple kind of stuff, maybe when you get to the next level and you have to react more and do different things, you're not as ready for it. I don't really know the answer to that. But I mean, just in general, I mean, you should get like a top 10 player, depending on where you pick. So obviously the higher you are in the draft, the higher that chance is. But if you're talking about a top 10 player, or a top 10 pick, top 10 kind of player. If you're talking about top pick in the draft, you'd want someone to be like top three at the position, I think would be your expectation. And then you drop down and down and down as you get further and further down the line. For example, what would be the expectation? So this isn't, it's position specific, but it's not taking into account specifics on the position. And what I mean by that is we don't necessarily look at what are the hit rates on a position by position basis. We do this overall, but for example, I just threw the Bills into the calculator. 25th pick, your expectation for a wide receiver picked at 25 would be a player who stands to make right now about $11.7 million a year. So, you can guesstimate. I mean, that would probably be a, top 20, 25 player, at the position. Now, if you took a team like the Jets who are picking four, and let's throw a wide receiver in for them at four, I'll throw a wide receiver in for them at 10. The expectations on those players are different. So if you're picking fourth overall, your expectation is like a top five, like around 20 a year. If you're picking number 10, it's around 16 a year. And that's probably around like 10, 11, 12 at the position, maybe 13. So it fluctuates as you go down the draft. So I would probably temper this a little bit for receivers just because my experience has been that a lot of the guys taken, don't hit, and those who do really do hit. So I don't know, that's just a gut feel. I don't think that the mega contracts for receivers changes the amount that are taken long term in the first round. I think the majority of teams are pretty set in their ways, the way they evaluate and the way they make those decisions. So I don't think that's going to necessarily change it. Maybe it'll put a little bit of a push more towards focusing on that. But I think for the most part, there's a number of teams that do realize that the way that the offenses are now, where you have so many targets and the targets are not alpha specific, alpha receiver specific, or what would have been in the past, someone would call the diva receiver, but you don't have those guys that dominate the offense, relative to the rest of the passing game, the way that like a Michael Irvin did, or the way a Terrell Owens might have, or, the way some of those players would just kind of dominate, the systems. Now, I've spoken about this before, like on a fantasy basis, it's almost like, okay, it's this guy's turn this week, it's this guy's turn the next week, it's this guy's turn the following week, and then we'll get back to number one. And, sometimes it's what that top receiver does more to help his teammates than what he's going to do specifically on his own. So I think the systems the lack of being able to be physical, the line with the receivers, the real push on the slot players. I think that all kind of leads to more and more of an emphasis on volume of receivers versus necessarily having the super top flight receiver. So I think that is it. Let me just see. A couple more questions here and then we'll wrap up. Let's see. Proud Black Matt says, what positions are you hoping the Jets draft in the first round, assuming they can't trade down? So, I mean, basically what I talked about before, I would like the Jets to draft like pass rusher, wide receiver. I wouldn't be against them taking an offensive tackle. I think that you have to have worries about Becton at this point. Maybe they don't need an offensive tackle right now. I wouldn't be against that. And then shop Becton and see what you can get for him. I guess he's not working out with the team. I don't really understand that. But maybe he's got his reasons for it. But yeah. Chase says, how much cap room would you need if you acquired picks 1 to 32 in the draft? Assuming no other picks and standard contract. I'd have to calculate that. I'm not sure what the first-round rookie pool is. I don't have it in front of me, the entire rookie pool for the first round. Let's see. Let me see if I can find that. All right, let's see. 2022. So my estimate would be the first 32 picks in the draft, if you could acquire all 32 picks. Let's see. You would need $109.24 million in cap space. And if you were actually replacing 32 minimum salary guys on your team, it'd be $86.7 million in net cap room. So that's what the rookie cost on the cap will be this year for every team in the league. Last question. How does player share the money get accounted for, i.e. 48% of TV money is supposed to go to the players? Is a PA do an audit to ensure this is happening? So, they do have some kind of rights to look over some of the stuff. I'm not up on that. I don't pay that kind of attention to it. I'm sure they have access to go over some stuff, based on the different things. I think what they don't have access to are the individual books for the teams, but that they're able to get looks at the revenues and stuff, make sure everything's on the up and up. I don't think that's ever been an issue. All right, so I think that does it for me. So hopefully I'll be back next weekend. Hopefully I'll have beer of the week next week, and we'll do a little Saturday night session. So everybody have a great week, and I will talk to you all again soon.